Good morning or afternoon. This is Professor Nick Burnett, and this is a lecture on persuasion. I am going to have some comments not only on what's in the text in the final chapter of concerning persuasion, but I'm also going to have some comments related to the persuasion assignments that you'll all be doing in your with your GAs. I'm going to talk a little bit about those speeches, the kind of topics that I think are appropriate, and the kind of speeches that we want to have. I know that in some past classes, people have done sales speeches, but in my particular section, sections 11 through 18, that is not an acceptable speech. We're going to be doing speeches related to policies or even attitude change that you believe needs to be affected in a particular business. So I'll get to that in just a second. It's important that you, as you're considering topics for these persuasive speeches, remember once again that for 4 weeks, you people are in control of the agenda in your GA sections. You're going to be doing speeches, persuasive speeches, for 4 weeks. If you choose boring or stupid topics, I'm afraid that's what you're going to be listening to for 4 weeks. And so it really, some of the onus, some of the burden of responsibility of making this an interesting class falls to you. Again, your GA or you can talk to you about an acceptable topic. You can always email me or drop in by my office hours, and I would be more than happy to chat with you about appropriate topics for these persuasive speeches. I want to begin with some definitions about persuasion, contrast it to what we did in the informative speeches earlier in the semester, and try and get a sense of what are some of the big questions that face people who are trying to persuade folks in organizations, in businesses. What are the big questions that they ask? Let me begin with a definition that actually comes from another textbook, but I think is very important. I actually alluded to this when I talked about the informative speeches, and that is when we're talking about persuading somebody, we're talking about limiting the options that are perceived as acceptable. In informative speaking, you're putting out more and more options. You're providing a greater range of options for your audience. But when you're actually trying to persuade somebody, you're actually doing the reverse. You're trying to limit the number of options that are perceived to be acceptable. You're trying to say, this is the solution that takes care of the problem facing our company. Not this one, not that one, but this one. You're limiting the range of options that are perceived as acceptable. And you do that by presenting sound evidence and sound arguments to those folks. I want to, in a sense, contrast persuasion, or at least maybe put it on a continuum, somewhere between coercion, come to the party or the dog dies, right? That's coercion. You're not persuading anybody to come to that party. You're saying that some horrible act will be committed in their name if they don't come to the party. Simply informing them about the party is not necessarily about persuading them. It might be a necessary first step. So I think what you've got really is this long continuum that runs from informing on one end and coercion on the other. And somewhere in that great middle, I think you find what it is we're talking about today, which is persuading people, providing them perhaps with good reasons to adopt your particular attitude or behavior, to adopt a policy. Any of those things, I think, can be explained within that continuum. My discipline in communication studies has studied issues related to persuasion for probably 2,500 years. We talked in the informative lecture about Aristotle a little bit, and I'm going to return to Aristotle today. One of the great issues going all the way back to ancient Greece in talking about persuasion is whether or not you ultimately view persuasion as a rational or a non-rational act. That is, that people come to be persuaded because they see good reasons and they see great evidence, or do they come to be persuaded simply by a fluke, simply by the emotions of the moment? We know that from marketing, for instance, that there are some products that people buy after lots of careful research. They've, checked out all the consumer magazines and they know which product is most highly rated. And we also know that when you go through the checkout line at the grocery store, there are some items that get bought simply on the spur of the moment, those impulse buys. I can't believe that anybody actually sets out to go to the grocery store to buy Slim Jims, but it seems to me people buy Slim Jims because it's at that moment at the cash register when they go, that sounds really good, I'm going to buy a Slim Jim. So I think that as we talk about ways to persuade people and the theories and the kind of schools of thought on how to persuade people, I think one of the things that you'll see as we talk about each one of these is the various theorists and schools of thought and persuasion where people kind of veer back and forth between persuasion involves rationality or persuasion is essentially an irrational kind of thing. You'll see the theorists kind of grappling with those issues, and when critics line up to criticize a school of thought in persuasion, one of the first things they'll usually do is go back to this touchstone and say, well, you know, this particular school of thought insufficiently captures the rational elements involved in persuasion, or maybe they're overly rational and they don't seem to appreciate the non-rational side of persuasion. So as we look at these various schools of thought, and that's really what we're going to do, I'm going to talk to you about some various groups of scholars and thinkers who have really worked with this notion of persuasion and tried to set out some guidelines, some theories, ways of thinking about the task of persuading other people. But one of the things to keep in mind, as I said, is whether or not you believe that persuasion is essentially a rational or a non-rational enterprise. One of the other things that we all have to grapple with as we're thinking about doing persuasive speeches is maybe make a distinction, and rhetorical scholars for years have made this distinction, about whether you're simply speaking to change somebody's mind or whether you're actually attempting to persuade them to change their behavior. One scholar talked about this as the difference between speaking to convince versus speaking to actuate. Are you intent only on attitude change, or are you really intent on behavior change? Now, you know, if you're a traditional business person and you're trying to sell widgets, it would be nice if everybody thought that your widgets were the best widgets in the market and you've persuaded them, you've changed their attitudes towards Burnett widgets. But if ultimately they don't go into the store and buy Burnett widgets, you probably really haven't accomplished your purpose because it's not enough for the market to feel good about your product. What you really need is for people to act on those attitudes and actually purchase your product. That difference between arguments that simply change people's minds and arguments that actually change people's behavior has been referred to both in the communication studies discipline and in psychology, where they study things like attitude change. It's been called the attitude-behavior dichotomy. And what for years scholars have tried to figure out is, why is it that some arguments are good for changing people's minds, that is, altering their attitudes, but that those same arguments may not be very good in actually motivating people and getting people to act? And I think what that means is that every person who attempts to persuade needs to take a moment to try and think about whether what they're doing is, are they trying for attitude change or are they trying for behavioral change? And then have the messages that you've designed really been designed with those particular goals in mind. So, for instance, we've pretty much convinced everybody in the United States that smoking is probably dangerous. The attitudes have changed on that, right? Nobody thinks this is a good thing. Nobody thinks having all those carcinogens in your lungs is a happy and pleasant thing. And yet, we still have a lot of people in this country who smoke. So obviously, just changing their mind about whether or not smoking is dangerous is not enough. You have to be able to convince them to stop smoking as well. And that may require different arguments, and it may require a different strategy than simply getting people to think that smoking is a nasty habit. two of the more kind of celebrated causes that we're still working on with the general public. One has to do with seatbelt use. You know, we've pretty much gotten to the point where people understand that it's probably a really good idea for traffic safety for folks to be buckled in, because if they're not, they tend to be launched when there are auto accidents. The question is, though, how do you actually get people to buckle up? Now, the truth is, the state of California has been marvelously successful, and the rates for buckling up in the state of California, I think, are upwards of 90% and perhaps even higher than that. We certainly have one of the highest rates of seatbelt usage in the United States. But for those states where seatbelt usage is not very high, how do they design campaigns to get people to buckle up? Because we know that buckling up saves lives. The other kind of classic persuasive health campaign that's been going on for a number of years is using condoms in order to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. We've pretty much, I think, convinced people that wearing a condom is a good thing, that it does prevent you against, prevents disease. It does prevent, in almost all cases, pregnancies that might result from the act. But again, telling people, you know, or trying to convince people to actually use the condom instead of having positive feelings towards using condoms is a completely different thing. And so as you approach the topic that you're going to be using for your persuasive speech, I think you need to keep in mind this whole attitude-behavior dichotomy and be sure that the arguments that you've kind of strung together in your speech really are focused on the goal that you actually want to get to, which is either changing minds or changing behavior. We know that in organizations, persuasion happens in lots of different contexts and in lots of different settings. The classic use for persuasion has always been kind of in public, right? People give public speeches in order to change people's minds. Political candidates want to convince you that they're the best person for the job. And within the business setting, of course, we are, you know, in a public company, there are always public stockholder events. There are large meetings of people who have a financial interest in a company. And you may need at times to meet with those people and to deliver a speech and persuade them that a particular course of action is appropriate. For instance, you've decided to sell off all but the core businesses and have your particular business really concentrate on what got them where they were. That's kind of traditional persuasion in a public setting, but we know that there are other kinds of settings. For instance, we know there are formal one-on-one settings that are designed around persuasion. A sales call by a salesperson to a particular company is, of course, a persuasive event. It may often be one-on-one. It's not public. It's not in an auditorium. You don't need a microphone. And yet, you're still meeting with another person and trying to change their attitude and probably their behavior as well. And so we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about sales calls. In fact, in the business school, you have a whole course about sales and about how to close deals and how to cultivate relationships and how to keep track of contacts. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that, but it is certainly, let's acknowledge that that's part of, well, an important part of persuasion that goes on in organizations. But the other one I want you to appreciate is just that there, as there are informal lines of communication that develop within an organization, there are also informal opportunities for you to persuade people. People are always forming impressions about you and about your department and about the policies you advocate. And if you're a person of goodwill and you treat people with respect, it's likely they're going to have a more positive attitude towards the things that you're trying to present. You're always being evaluated in a business setting, whether you're sitting in the break room or whether you're interacting with folks from other departments. All of those are opportunities, in a sense, for persuasion. And I just want you to kind of have a sense that as you kind of conduct yourself in an organization, understand that persuasion happens really all the time. I'm going to begin talking about some different sets or schools of thought, some different theorists about persuasion. Some of these you may have had some exposure to before, because if you've had a good marketing course, We'll get to the point where we talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because I'll probably be about the 10th class that you've actually had that discussed. But I'm also going to talk about some others that you probably will not have heard about before, but have really had a profound impact on the way people come to understand persuasion. The first one that I want to talk about is called the Yale School of Persuasion Research. That's Yale. That's Yale as in New Haven, Connecticut, Yale University. What happened is after World War II, many of the people that the Army had employed to design propaganda and to think about ways of inoculating the U.S. population against propaganda from other countries. When World War II was all done, those people were no longer needed, but they all had PhDs, and they were all looking for ways to continue their research into the area of persuasion. And a bunch of them ended up the corridor from Washington, D.C., in New Haven, Connecticut, at Yale University. And the leader of that group was a fellow by the name of Carl Hovland. And Professor Hovland and his colleagues from the end of the 1940s all the way through the 1950s and on into the 1960s did an awful lot of research about how persuasion happens. And they began to build essentially a model, a way of thinking about persuasion, of conceptualizing the persuasive process that allowed them to continue to do their research. And I want to talk very briefly about that model, and you see it on the PowerPoint slide in front of you. It had 5 steps. I'll just speak to those steps and then go back through them briefly. The first is attention. You have to get somebody's attention if you're going to actually persuade them. The second is comprehension. They have to understand the message. Third is acceptance. It's also called yielding in some models, but really it's about actually getting people to accept your message. The next is retention. It's not enough to simply, be persuaded at that moment. When they go back to the store, you want them to buy your product. They need to remember the message that you've constructed. And then final step is action. We want them to move beyond simply changing their attitude to actually change their behavior. And so Hovland and his colleagues at Yale University spent upwards of 20 years developing this model, presenting research that would support this model, and they would go through and do specialized research in each of these areas, on each of these steps within the model, to try and demonstrate that the model is an accurate one, and that's the way people actually go through and come to be convinced and come to be persuaded. So, for instance, taking up the first one, attention. For a long time, people who teach public speaking have spoken to their classes about the need to have an attention-getting step in their introduction. Really, the reason we believe that, well, we may have long believed that, but the reason we have scientific support for that is the work that Hovland and the Yale folks did to demonstrate that, yes, getting people's attention is a good, necessary precondition for persuasion to occur. If you don't have people attending to the message, if you don't have people locked in and focused, it's unlikely you're going to have persuasion, at least in their model. Comprehension was the second step of the model, and really the way they operationalized that kind of research was to demonstrate that speeches that were better organized had more persuasive impact than speeches that were not well organized. And they would simply take the same content for a persuasive message, but alter the way in which it was organized, and they were able to demonstrate that good logical organization led to better comprehension, which led to more persuasion. The third step was acceptance. That is, that you had to actually get people to yield to your message, to come to see that your point of view was correct, and that in and of itself was an important step. Retention meant that people had to remember your message or remember that they had in fact changed their mind. And they explored, Hovland and the folks at Yale explored a number of different ways to get people to retain a message. The use of music, for instance, a catchy jingle might well get people to buy your product or to remember that when they see the golden arches, that's what they intend to do, is to go off and find McDonald's food. They looked at how often messages are repeated. So, for instance, if you look at some of the commercials that are on kind of regular play these days on local television stations, the buyers for those media ads may have determined that we're not going to spend so much of our money on the actual shooting of the ad and the production of the ad. We're going to spend our money on the media buy. And so we have a fairly simplistic commercial, but we just, you know, run the snot out of it. It's on TV all the time. And that's designed to get people to retain that message, that we simply show it to them enough that they'll remember it. The final step in the Yale School was action, that is, trying to get people to move beyond simply changing their attitudes. And what Hovland and the folks at Yale really came to understand in this step was you have to tell people what you want. You tell them to buy your product. You tell them to vote for your candidate. You tell them to go to the store, to make the reservation, to reserve your, you know, new car down at the Toyota dealership, whatever it is. They often found that simply a direct appeal to action, telling people how they could consummate this particular exchange between folks, was you just had to let them know what to do. And so the Yale School, over these 20 years between the late 40s and early 60s, really began to crystallize a way of thinking about persuasion. Now, the Yale School was not without its critics, and I think that in some cases those criticisms are pretty well, they're serious, there's no doubt about it. One of the first criticisms of the Yale School had to do with the fact of who it was they were actually studying. If you think about what the population of students likely was at Yale University from the late 40s to the early 60s, I think you would have probably easily found that it was an overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, overwhelmingly middle to upper middle class and even high class folks. I mean, this was an Ivy League university that cost a lot of money to go to. This was in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when it was far more likely that the people who were actually accepted at Yale University were there not simply because of their grades, but because they were legacies. They were the sons, maybe the daughters, but mostly the sons of folks who had already gone to Yale. George Bush, right? Okay. Here's a notion that the people that you've used to populate the studies that you've used to validate this model, this understanding of persuasion, are such a narrow slice of the American population that it's probably not reasonable to think that you could actually generalize based on this kind of very narrow population stratification as being appropriate for the entire population. So that's, I think, a serious and legitimate criticism, though some of their later work was redone and reconfirmed using kind of more general populations and kind of a less restrictive audience. A second criticism, which again I think is probably reasonably legitimate, is that folks have argued that the Hovland model, the Yale School of Persuasion Research, is far too linear and far too rational. That is, they think that persuasion happens in five steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that it has to happen in that order, that it has to happen in that particular way, and that all of the steps contain rational issues. And if you'll recall what I said at the beginning of the lecture, this kind of swinging back and forth between the less rational and the rational suggests that the critics thought that Hovland had gone too far to the rational. So while I think that they've had a profound impact on how we come to understand persuasion, they are certainly not the whole deal. And there were other folks who began to work at almost the same time who went in a decidedly different direction. Abraham Maslow is somebody that you probably have already confronted in a marketing class or in a psychology class. Abraham Maslow was interested in trying to determine why people act the way they do, and his argument was that ultimately people make decisions, even marketing decisions, even going to purchase which brand of toothpaste they want to purchase, based on the satisfaction of particular needs. And his hierarchy of needs, of which you've probably seen 1,000 renderings with the pyramid, with the base as the most profound and basic needs, and the top of the pyramid being the ones that are the most esoteric, ultimately suggested that that's how marketers, that's how people in the advertising business might use Maslow's understandings of people's needs to generate product buying and behavior. And for instance, his most basic need, as you undoubtedly remember, is physiological needs. That is, there's nothing more important than air or water. Breathing is like a really good thing that people like to do. And when you deprive people of those things, that will be the most motivating thing in their lives. So if you can somehow identify your product as being as basic as needing air or water, you're going to have a very profound way to motivate people to kind of get out and buy your product. If you move up the pyramid from physiological needs, you get to security needs. After air and water, shelter is really important in people's lives. They need to feel safe. They need to feel like they're, you know, protected. And providing shelter, providing security is an important thing. And so here again, I think you'll see that car makers have spent a lot of time in the last 2 years trying to pitch their products, not simply on how cool they look, but ultimately how safe they are. And they've recognized that they can use this safety aspect, this security aspect, as a way of making sure that their family is safe, that you need to have all these airbags, and the result is that this is the car they ought to purchase. The third step up on Maslow's hierarchy is, remember, social or love needs. People need to feel connected to other people. And, you know, if you look at, cell phone ads, it seems to me that the marketers have exploited this pretty well. The need to feel connected to your family, the need to feel, you know, have your five friends in your cell phone is an important thing. And so you see this being exploited even today. There are certainly ripples of Maslow's hierarchy of needs that still exist in marketing campaigns all across the country. The fourth step up the pyramid was called esteem needs. That is, that people had egos that essentially needed to be fed. People need to feel like they're good at something. People need to feel like there's something that kind of, you know, is special about them, and that having a particular product or satisfying that particular product might satisfy that need. At the very top of the pyramid, and Maslow is absolutely the one who kind of introduced this term, and again, you've probably heard it in different contexts, not even connected to Maslow's name. He said that the thing that will, at the final point, drive humans is their need to be self-actualized. That's a big word, self-actualized. What are we talking about? We're talking about the need to feel like they've met the full flower of human development, that they've become the person they were meant to be, that they're doing a job that really satisfies them not only financially, but also emotionally, that it's what they really expect they should have been. And so Maslow argues that in the very last kind of result, the way you motivate people who have their other needs met is to push towards self-actualization. You should go to college because it will allow you to become the person that you ultimately are. Remember that Maslow also suggested that the most basic needs are satisfied or need to be satisfied first. So when people use Maslow to persuade other people, they should try and hook their proposal or their product or what it is they're trying to sell to the very lowest part of the pyramid they possibly can. You can, I think, see Maslow's hierarchy of needs as a reaction, in a sense, to Hovland's research. Hovland was very linear. Hovland was very rational. Where here with Maslow, we're talking about needs, which are not necessarily rational. Some of them probably are, but not necessarily. And so in a way, it's seen as a reaction to the Hovland school, to the Yale School of Social Research, which suggests that there's this, you know, irrational or non-rational element to persuasion that needs to be pursued. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, as those of you who have taken an advertising class know, was profoundly influential by the late 1950s and into the 60s in Madison Avenue, that is, in advertising. And the result is that it exists, I think, even today. So Maslow's hierarchy of needs, certainly an area that has had a profound effect on the way we come to see persuasion working. This next theorist is probably someone that you have not bumped into before, but I would argue that in many ways this person presents the most complete and arguably most interesting approach to studying persuasion. His name is Robert Cialdini, that's Cialdini, And he's written a book that's gone through a couple of different editions now. It's simply called Influence. Influence. Let me tell you, if you have a chance to pick up this book, you know, even an older edition, I would absolutely do it. It makes wonderful reading. It is not academic prose. The whole deal, actually, there's an interesting story. For years, Cialdini was a psychologist who did studies of attitude change in laboratories. He would set up laboratory experiments. He would run people through the lab experiments. He would write up the results, and he would publish them as many traditional academics do. And at some point in his career, he kind of began to have a kind of crisis of faith of whether or not the laboratory experiments that he had been running for all these years truly reflected the way people come to be persuaded in the real world. He knew how things worked in the laboratory, but he was not as convinced that he understood persuasion and how it happened in the real world. So when confronted with this crisis of faith, he did what many good academics do. He took a sabbatical, and he went out, and he actually pursued persuasion in the real world. And he began to do things like sit in on sermons. And he went to Kirby vacuum cleaner training classes. And he would go out to county fairs and listen to the people who sold Ginsu knives. And he would go out and really embrace chances to encounter persuasion in the real world and what the scientists would call in situ. That is, out not in the laboratory, but out there in the real world. Well, an interesting result of all of his hard work in the field was that he came back and he said, you know what, I think there are six principles that guide our ability to persuade other people. He called them his principles of persuasion. Many of them were ones that he had worked with before in the laboratory. He's not entirely convinced that any of the ones that he has kind of put together for this book called Influence are new necessarily, but rather they kind of survey the way that both science and the real world confronts persuasion. And he thinks that these are six pretty exhaustive ways of thinking about how persuasion happens. And so let me just run through the six things rather quickly. Let me also recommend that if you get the chance to go out and buy Cialdini's book, it is absolutely worth the read. It's funny, it's charming, there's stuff there that you'll just roar about, and it's very thought-provoking. And as I said, even if you can find an older edition for a buck on a resale bin, go ahead and pick it up because you'll absolutely enjoy it. I like to call it bathroom reading because it has good short chapters, and you can read it anytime. Anyway, back to the six principles. The first one he talks about is called reciprocation. And it really comes down to this, that if somebody does something for you, we tend to turn around and want to do something for them. So if we get a free sample in the mail of a product, we're more likely to try it. If you go walking around Costco or Sam's Club, those ladies who are making, you know, offering up the quarter of a hamburger of a frozen patty that they're selling over in the freezer cases, what people realize is that if you give them something, they'll want to turn around and do something appropriate for you, like, oh, buy their product. And it's not simply that you're tasting the burger and going, oh, this is really interesting, but it's the mere act of being given something for nothing that makes us want to reciprocate. And in fact, I have my own sad tale to tell that a couple of years before I got married, the wife and I were down on a little island right off of Florida's west coast called Sanibel. And we were confronted by a fellow in a parking lot of a shopping center saying that if we would come and listen to the sales pitch for a timeshare condominium, that he would give us a $50 gift certificate for a meal on the island. We thought that was pretty cool. I thought I was pretty resistant to all this stuff, and we figured we'd go, we'd listen to the 45-minute presentation, we would end up with our $50 gift certificate. And of course, lo and behold, when all was said and done, dinner cost me about $6,000 because we ended up buying the damn condo. It was a timeshare, right? So you own a week or two is the way it went. oh my goodness, what a horrible thing. They convinced us it was going to be a great investment. Actually, it wasn't so bad. We actually ended up honeymooning there. We went back a couple of times during the 10 years that we owned it. And then any year we didn't actually go back to Sanibel, we were able to rent it. So it didn't really, you know, cost us. But at the end, when we were trying to get rid of it, our only hope was that we could find two people stupider than we were to actually buy this thing from us. And of course, they bought it at about a third of the price that we bought it for 10 years earlier. So not exactly what you'd call a great investment. But boy, we simply got, you know, I think one of the explanations is we got sucked in by reciprocation. This guy gave us this gift certificate for $50 for a good meal at a nice restaurant on the island. And boy, you know, I'd like to think that I'm immune from this stuff, but I certainly got pulled right in. A second principle that Cialdini talks about in his book is called commitment and consistency, the notion that behavior follows belief. We all like to believe that, you know, if we're moral, that we will act morally. If we're smart, we'll act smartly. And that advertisers can begin to exploit this notion of commitment and consistency. You bought a Toyota the last time, they want you to buy a Toyota this time. Why would you change to a Hyundai if you had such good, you know, experience with the Hyundai? Commitment and consistency can be powerful tools to get us to behave in particular ways. The third one is social proof. We like to do things that we believe are socially acceptable. So if somebody asks you what brand of toothpaste you use, you probably won't admit to them that you haven't brushed your teeth in 3 years, because that's not socially acceptable. That's just gross, right? And so you say, oh, I don't know, Crest, and you tell them you use Crest toothpaste. That may not be true at all, but social proof suggests that you know, we're willing to vote for the candidate who may be on the outside, because socially it's acceptable to do that. We don't tell them that, no, we're going to vote for this person because, you know, my family has known his family forever, okay? Liking is the fourth of Cialdini's principles of persuasion, and you see this all the time in advertising, right? We like Tiger Woods, we like Michael Jordan, therefore the producers hope that we will buy the products that these folks hawk. So whether it's a Buick or whether it's Gatorade or Hanes underwear or whatever it is, these two kind of icons of marketing in the United States are pitching these days, advertisers know that because these folks have such high likability quotients, not simply because of their athletic prowess, but also because they're very likable people. They seem to be approachable. They seem to be splendid human beings. And the result is liking can be exploited very powerfully by advertisers to make sure that we buy whatever it is these folks like. It's just a matter of liking. Authority is the fifth principle of persuasion, and it simply states that Americans respond to authority. How else could you possibly explain the success of a commercial where somebody comes on in a white doctor's coat and says, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV, and I recommend that you use these particular brands of aspirins? Oh my goodness, this is just enormously disturbing at some level, because they even tell you that they're not an authority. They just dress up like one and play one on TV, and yet even so, that commercial must be successful. It's run over the course of the years. That pitch, that notion that we respond to symbols of authority. How else could you explain the high incidence of folks who use fake university degrees? Credibility is built around authority. If you have an advanced degree, it's perceived that you're, you know, smarter or better than the other person who comes along. And as a result, there's certainly a motivation for people to go out and, get these degrees where you hardly do any work. Just ask John Gray, the fella who has been pimping his books, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, for all these years. The guy got a PhD at a, well, it's hard for me to call it a school because it was actually a set of offices over a dry cleaner in Marin County. But yet he still goes out and, you know, promotes his books and has PhD after his name, even though he did about as much work for his degree as I probably do on a weekend. Do I sound bitter? Do I sound bitter? I guess I sound a little bitter, so maybe I shouldn't say that. But the truth is, we do respond to authority, and folks have figured that out. The final one that I want to talk about for Cialdini is called scarcity. And we see this appeal all the time in marketing. 3 days only. This price only good today. Oh, no, we couldn't give you that price on the card tomorrow because I can only make this deal in the next 2 hours. Those are all scarcity appeals. They all suggest that there's only one chance, that there's very little, that there's a lot of competition for the thing that we're looking for, and therefore we ought to act. Cialdini, in his book, tells a great story about his brother who put himself through college by buying cars, fixing them up very modestly, like just polishing them or changing the tires, and then putting the car up for sale. And he was always able to sell it for more than he bought the car for, even with very little work, because what he would do is he would set up the sale in such a way that when people would call about the ad and say they wanted to come and see the car, he would say, well, the only time I can do it is between 12 and 1 on Saturday. And the more people that called, the better, because what would happen is they would all show up together. And if you've got 4 or 5 people all looking at the same car, the sense is, oh my God, if I don't buy it, somebody else will, so I'm going to jump on it. And Cialdini says that his brother not only would sell the cars, but he would sell them at a price above what he had originally intended for the sticker price, simply because he had this competition. Scarcity can be a powerful tool. You know, if this sale ends in 2 days, oh my God. So it's a great activator. It's something that you can use to go beyond attitude change and get people to actually change their behavior because they believe the product or the price is scarce. Anyway, I think I've talked enough about Cialdini. Please, if you have a chance, go out and find his book, Influence, and I think you'll really enjoy it. The next one that I have listed here and that you'll find in your PowerPoint slides is called Monroe's Motivated Sequence. And this is discussed in your book, so I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time with it. But Monroe was a public speaking teacher in the early 1950s, and he kind of built a book around this kind of arrangement pattern or strategy for constructing persuasive speeches. And in a way, it's actually both, right? It's both a pattern for constructing your speech, but it's also an inventional device. That is, it responds to this notion of it tells you what to go out and find for the speech and then how to adapt it to a particular audience. Monroe believed this is the way people actually came to be persuaded. And though I don't think that there was any ever any real persuasive evidence that this was somehow a model for persuasion, Monroe certainly made was the, you know, the model for a generation of speakers on how to construct persuasive speeches. We could have made the persuasive speech assignment built around this particular motivated sequence, and it would have been an easy thing for most of you to do. Monroe's motivated sequence, I think you can hear echoes of both Hovland and Maslow in it, and I think you'll find it very attractive. And if you want to use it as the organizational device for your persuasive speech, more power to you. His 5 steps, right? The first was an attention step. Right, just sounds just like Hovland, that you have to get people's attention before you can persuade them. The second step was a need step. Now I'm hearing Maslow a little bit. You have to tell people why they need to be listening to you. What information do you have, or what problem have you addressed that's relevant to the audience's life? The third step is called the satisfaction step. That's where you outline the solution that fulfills the need that you've established in the second step. And then probably the most innovative, the most unique part of Monroe's motivated sequence is in the 4th step. He called it the visualization step. And his argument was that what you need to do is help the audience to imagine what their lives would be like if they in fact adopted the point of view or the policy that you're talking about. That would then be followed up with a specific action step that was intended to overcome the attitude-behavior dichotomy, that it was designed to get people not to simply change their mind, but to actually change their behavior. If you look at the next slide, what I've actually done is outline what would be a typical persuasive speech using Monroe and using his motivated sequence. And so let's look at that real briefly, right? If you were going to do a persuasive speech on why we ought to improve workplace safety, well, the first step, of course, is you got to get people's attention. What would be a great way of getting people's attention? Well, it might be a personal experience that you had as you narrowly escaped the cardboard crusher at the Safeway grocery store, or that, you know, you could hold up your hand with only 8 digits and explain to them that when you were a meat cutter at that Safeway, you had a runaway blade. Something personal, something shocking, gruesome statistics about how many people fall into industrial meat grinders every year, something like that. Obviously, you'd want to get people's attention. The next is you'd have to establish a need. Why should the people in this room care about workplace safety? And so you might use statistics to establish the number of people who get injured in the workplace. You might even demonstrate that workplace safety is not just in blue-collar jobs, but that also there are thousands of injuries every year in white-collar jobs. Do your best to establish that there's a need. You then try to explain how to satisfy that need or how to solve that problem. That's the third step of Monroe's motivated sequence. And you might argue that through aggressive employee education and stricter enforcement of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration standards, that that's the best way to ensure workplace safety. Again, then you move to the unique step of visualizing what the world would be like if we had better workplace safety. And you might argue some of the implications of better workplace safety are things like lower worker comp costs, which might in fact mean that there's more money around a business for raises or better benefits. And so you can actually have people visualize what the world would be like if they embraced your point of view. Finally, of course, you have to get people to do more than simply assent, more to simply be convinced, but to actually change their behavior. So give them the information of how they would go about these things. How do they get in touch with the local office of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration? Why is it that your insurance company would be a great place to start? Because they can help you institute employee education, because they want you to have fewer injuries on the job because they're an insurance company. And, you know, ultimately, I think you could craft a pretty good speech here. It would be persuasive, and it would follow Monroe's motivated sequence would be just great. I want to talk very briefly, I think, about alternative organizational patterns. We started this class when we talked about the informative speech with some very basic kind of things. Your textbook in the chapter at the end about persuasive speaking and in the chapters on doing persuasive speeches offers you some alternative organizational patterns, some of the ones that seem to be most used for people doing persuasive speeches would be a problem-solution format, right? You lay out a problem, you demonstrate it to everybody, and they explain how to solve it. There's something called the criteria satisfaction format, where what you do is take a problem that everybody already understands and agrees is a problem, and instead of spending a lot of time on the problem, you actually spend some time talking about the various solutions that have already been proposed. You establish what would be the important criteria for knowing which solution is best, and then you would go through the solutions and demonstrate the one that meets the criteria for solving the problem the best. Cause-effect solution is another kind of variation on both of those things. But let me spend a little time talking about a lesser-known kind of alternative organizational pattern for persuasive speeches. It's called indirect sequence. And indirect sequence is actually a very useful tool for when you find that the audience is hostile to your particular proposal. And this is a way of kind of backing into a particular policy rather than be shocked and have people just turn off from the beginning. This might be a way. So, for instance, indirect sequence says the first thing you do is establish that there's a problem. Okay, car thefts in the Central Valley are ridiculous. It's a problem that everybody pretty much acknowledges is a terrible thing. you want to outline the criteria for responses. How are the various ways that we've tried to stop car thefts or burglaries in general in the Central Valley? And we would try and then go on to disqualify that those alternatives really have not worked. Then what you do, after you've established that there's this problem, that there's been no good solution to fit so far, you present the unpopular solution. You present the one that kind of comes out of left field. Because there's so much car theft in the Central Valley related, frankly, to the production of methamphetamine, maybe what we ought to do is legalize drugs. Oh, my God. Now, you know, here the deal is, if you had started your speech by laying that out, you probably would have had a lot of rejection. But by kind of backing into it and say, look, other ways of solving the problems of crime associated with drug use have simply not worked. The war on drugs has simply not worked. Maybe what we need is a radical solution, and it looks like this. Again, it is often a very persuasive mechanism for getting people to listen to you when you know that they're going to be hostile to your particular topic. So I think that covers indirect sequence. Again, useful for hostile audiences, hostile to your point of view. When we were talking about informative speaking, one of the things we talked about is the credibility of the speaker and how that can impact the message that they're trying to send. Well, if it's true in informative speaking, it's probably even more true when we're talking about persuasive speeches. One of the things that you have to be mindful about is, how is the audience perceiving you? How are you as a source to be trusted? What knowledge, what expertise do you have? Do people perceive you as being trustworthy? Let's talk a little bit about credibility and break it down a little bit into extrinsic credibility, that is, the credibility that a speaker might have prior to an actual speaking engagement, and intrinsic credibility, which is the credibility that you might build within the actual speech, the things that you might do to get an audience to trust you. So let's look back at extrinsic credibility first. Extrinsic credibility, those things that we have prior to the actual speech, are things like our reputation, our resume, our credentials, our academic degrees. Those things, those markers that might be important to the audience in deciding whether or not to begin to trust us. It's why, for instance, you will see people being introduced with somebody kind of laying out all the qualifications for the expert who's going to be addressing the conference. And they do that because they're trying to establish that person's credentials and trying to get to explain essentially to the audience that this is somebody you can trust. They're an expert in the field. They've been doing this for a lot of years. You know, whatever the marker of that is, you have to be concerned, because there will be times in organizations when you will have a lot of external credibility, right? You've been with the company for 20 years. You have a degree in the area that you're kind of going to be speaking on. All of those things can be important for extrinsic credibility. But there are also times when you're going to be in an organization, particularly at the beginning of your career, where you don't have a lot of external credibility, extrinsic credibility. Nobody knows who you are. You're the new kid in the department. And so you may have to concentrate more on what's called intrinsic credibility, that is, the things that you do during the speech to get people to trust you. And what are those things? Well, we're talking about things like being organized, being appropriately dressed, making sure that you're quoting the right experts or referring to the right information, that this crowd will then know that you know what you're talking about. You do everything you can to build your intrinsic credibility, because frankly, you may not have a lot of extrinsic credibility because nobody knows who you are. Again, as you go through your career, it may be that various times of your career you have more extrinsic or more intrinsic credibility. You have to kind of have an assessment, a competent assessment of that as you move through. Earlier in the semester, we talked about the three dimensions of credibility. Remember, we were talking about ethos with Aristotle. And we had originally said that there are three dimensions of credibility that were established from the research in the communication studies field in the 50s and 60s. Those three dimensions were trustworthiness, expertise or competence, And then finally was this notion of dynamism, of being passionate, of being involved, of being, you know, a real advocate for what it is you're talking about. And while those are three important ones, I think we need to add two more when we're talking about public speeches in the context of a business. And there's been some research to suggest that these make sense as well. Fourth one that I would want to add is your ability to be objective affects your credibility, right? The situation is this. If you're always only advocating for things that help you or your department or your position in a business, people are not going to see you as an objective advocate who can look at the bigger picture. If you're always talking about short-term issues, if you're always only advocating things that help you or your department, you're not going to be seen as very objective. Can you, in a larger sense, argue for a point of view that does not benefit you or your department as well, but is rather good for the bigger picture of the company as a whole? Being objective is important. And then I think it's unavoidable because of issues of power in persuasion that organizational rank plays a role in perceptions of credibility. People believe that the CEO is a more credible source of information than the person who brings the mail around. Even though the person who brings the mail around may be a really good source of information, I think in this case, rank is something that you have to think about. So if you're lower ranked, you need to do more to establish your credibility. If you have high organizational rank, ultimately, I think your credibility is going to be pretty well in place simply because of where you are on the organizational chart. Some final thoughts on persuasion. I think the first is, as we mentioned with informative speaking, the real key to persuasion is understanding who your audience is and to make arguments that demonstrate that you're working with that audience so that you, the speaker, and the audience can work in tandem to get to a particular place. Now, the place you're bringing that audience may be a place that exactly you want, that you're going to persuade them to adopt a particular policy or to take a particular point of view, and that's fine. But ultimately, you have to show that you have adapted to a particular point of view. I saw a special last night on cable about Kathy Griffin, the comedian, and she was going to actually be doing a couple of shows in a prison in Arizona. And one of the things that she didn't simply walk into the prison at 7:30 at night and do her comedy routine. She actually spent part of a day meeting some of the prisoners, both the female prisoners and the male prisoners that she was going to do separate shows for. And she got to know what they thought was funny and what affected their lives and whether or not she could talk about their crimes. And it was different for both the men and the women. But she spent some time analyzing her audience because she knew that a comedy show needs to be well adapted, and that there are some things that some people think are funny and other things other people don't think are funny. And even between the men and the women's show that she did, she found that there were some topics that were particularly well-suited for the women that weren't well-suited for the men. And things about talking about their crimes, for instance, was very different in the men's and the women's shows. She was being an effective rhetor. She was being an effective advocate because she was analyzing her audience and she was making adaptations in her material for that audience. Though it is the next to the last bullet on the last slide in maybe what is the last lecture for this particular semester, ethics should not be an afterthought in the work that you do. One of the responsibilities of somebody who's going to go out and persuade other people is to make sure that you're acting ethically and that you're putting forth points of view and that you're using evidence in such a way that is defensible, that is ethical, and that that shows respect for your audience. Ultimately, this is an individual kind of question. Everybody may confront at some point in their career being asked to do something on behalf of the company that you may not agree with, whether it's to sell a product in a particular way, whether it's to respond to customers in a particular with a particular point of view. I think we all have to think about what our tolerances are for borderline ethical problems. And I think before you give a major presentation, it's a good point to stop and reflect and see whether or not the arguments that you've made and the positions that you've asked your audience to embrace are in fact ethical ones. Finally, what I would say is that as we began talking about informative speaking months ago, Aristotle was probably right. You could probably spend most of the time preparing for a persuasive speech simply looking at questions of ethos or credibility, looking at pathos or the way in which emotion is used in persuasion, and logos, that is, logical arguments constructed with persuasion in mind. Make sure that the arguments that you're putting together for your persuasive speeches are ones that are well evidenced, are ones that are well documented, so that people know that you're a credible source of information and that you're not simply kind of pulling this stuff out of thin air. Your role as an advocate is one that you have a lot of control over. And so as you kind of do this preparation, if you have questions, make sure that you talk to your GA. You can always send me an email at mburnett@csus.edu, or you can come by my office, which is in Mendocino 5006. Again, I wish you all the best of luck on your persuasive speeches, and take care.